That lines, Iran's president says the Islamic Republic will fulfill its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal once other signatories live up to their commitments. Afghanistan's defense ministry says at least two people have been killed in a Taliban attack in the eastern province of Ghazni. The German chancellor demands tougher measures to stem the spread of the coronavirus as Germany's death toll from the disease reaches a grim daily record of nearly 600 people. Hello and welcome everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the Iranian president says the possible return of the incoming U.S. administration to the 2015 nuclear deal neither needs negotiations nor takes time.
As I said before, it will take no time for both sides to return to their commitments. It just needs a will. How was the nuclear deal undermined? That illiterate businessman scrawled his signature on a piece of paper. It all happened with a scrawl. He brought some paper, scrawled his signature, and announced that he walked out of the nuclear deal. Now the next person can sign a good sheet of paper. It just needs a signature, and you're back to square one. It is as easy as this. It won't take time, nor does it require negotiations.
Rouhani was referring to U.S. President Donald Trump, who pulled out of the nuclear accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. He urged U.S. President-elect Joe Biden to rejoin the agreement and make up for the harms Trump did to the Iranian nation. Rouhani stressed Iran will resume the full implementation of the nuclear deal once all other parties live up to their obligations. He said Iran's reduction of commitments, including the installation of advanced centrifuges at its Natanz facility, can be reversed quickly. Political commentator Edward Corrigan believes Biden will throw out what he calls Trump's legacy of poison vis-a-vis Iran once he takes office.
If Biden, soon to be elected and confirmed, he can simply, throw out the Trump legacy of poison and bring it back and have a constructive engagement and signal a break between his administration and Donald Trump's administration and various policies and shenanigans that he employed to basically disrupt things. He creates chaos, and then out of chaos he seeks some sort of opportunity. But the Iranians are still abiding by the agreement. They've only taken a few small steps, which they are entitled to under Section 24 and 34 of the agreement. And they have, at least lukewarm and vocal support from the Europeans, as well as very strong support from the Russians and Chinese. So yes, I think this is a good opportunity for Biden to break a long string of chain of negative events that Donald Trump created, and to put the Iranian government and the other partners with this agreement back up to where they were before Donald Trump took over and destroyed the agreement.
Afghanistan's defense ministry says two security forces have been killed in an attack in the eastern province of Ghazni. The ministry says the attack targeted a military base and left three others wounded. It is blaming assault on the Taliban militant group. The ministry said three militants were killed in ensuing clashes. The incident came just days after the Afghan government and the Taliban agreed to continue peace talks. They began the negotiations in Qatar in September with the final goal of ending the years-long war in Afghanistan. The talks, however, have failed to reduce violence. Less than 2 weeks ago, a suicide attack killed 31 people in Ghazni. It was blamed on the Taliban. Amin Alami earlier joined us from Kabul and gave details about the attack in Ghazni province.
Well, this incident happened in Ghazni, the capital city of Ghazni province in southern Afghanistan. According to military sources there, two terrorists had planned to launch twin-track bomb blasts on an Afghan army base in Mullah Nuh Baba area of the city in southern Afghanistan, but Afghan forces identified them and opened fire on them. As a result, the driver of one of the trucks that was full of explosives were killed, and his truck was also exploded, and the second driver was escaped.
An alliance of 11 opposition parties in Pakistan has decided to resign from the national and provincial assemblies as part of their campaign to seek the ouster of Prime Minister Imran Khan. Kamran Yusuf has more in this report.
Leaders of an alliance of 11 opposition parties in Pakistan gathered in Islamabad to decide their future action plan against the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan. The alliance, named Pakistan Democratic Movement, was launched in September this year to seek the ouster of Prime Minister Khan. The alliance that included mainstream parties such as Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz and Pakistan People's Party claims that Khan came to power through rigged elections in 2018. After their deliberations, they decided to use resignation from national and provincial assemblies to achieve their objective.
By December 31st, opposition lawmakers from provincial and national assemblies will hand in their resignations to their respective party heads.
The ruling Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf has a thin majority in the National Assembly. If opposition parties resign, this may trigger a major political crisis in the country.
Opposition does not want Pakistan to enter an era where institutions are respected and independent, and where there is a level playing field. Tell me, how can the opposition say that the government should go home just because corruption era of opposition has come to an end?
Prime Minister Khan's party came to power after the July 2018 elections. It was the first time government was formed by other than the two mainstream political parties. Khan says opposition parties want to see him go since he is not willing to give them amnesty over the corruption cases. But opposition rejects his claim, saying his two-year rule has only brought disaster to the country, both on the political and economic front.
The anti-government alliance is all set to hold next week a major public rally in Lahore, the political powerhouse of Pakistan. While the opposition insists the government has to go, Prime Minister Imran Khan is adamant he will complete his five-year term. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will head to Brussels in an effort to clinch a post-Brexit trade deal with the European Union. Johnson is set to meet European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen later on Wednesday. The meeting follows months of talks deadlocked over several key issues, including fair competition. Johnson has called the current situation tricky. EU officials have urged London to make compromises, saying they will not accept a deal at any price. Both sides have spoken of a no-deal Brexit if no breakthrough is achieved. The UK left the EU in January. It's now in a transition period that expires at the end of the year. That's also the deadline for reaching a deal on future trade ties. The number of confirmed COVID cases in Europe has surpassed the grim milestone of 20 million as the continent is struggling with a second wave of the disease. Germany on Wednesday reported a new daily record of 590 new deaths in 24 hours. That brings the country's overall death toll to almost 20,000. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has demanded stricter curbs amid the upcoming holiday season to slow the virus surge in her country. Also on Wednesday, Ukraine registered a record number of daily deaths with 276 new fatalities. The country also recorded more than 12,000 new cases in 24 hours. Europe is the worst affected region by the pandemic. It accounts for 40% of new cases reported worldwide in the past 7 days. Just 10 months since the COVID-19 pandemic hit, the UK has begun to administer a vaccine. This is the beginning of a mass inoculation initiative that the whole world hopes will signal the beginning of the end of this pandemic. Bianca Raimi tells us more.
Here in the UK, Margaret Keenan, who turns 91 next week, has received what she calls an early birthday present, the first of 800,000 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. She has been self-isolating alone since March and was pleased to get the jab.
I thought it was a joke, to tell you the truth, to start with. I couldn't believe it, you know, but I'm happy it's happened. And now I've done it, and hopefully it'll help other people come along.
At this initial phase, the elderly, vulnerable and NHS staff have been given priority. The effects of the vaccine are expected to kick in 12 days after administration, and Margaret and everyone else receiving the jab will have another dose in 3 weeks. Full immunity can be expected a month after the first dose. In the meantime, people are being asked to stick to the rules.
My message would be, it's amazing to see the vaccine coming out. It's amazing to see this tremendous shot in the arm for the entire nation, but we can't afford to relax now.
The scientists say life might start to go back to normal by April. The British government is touting this as a success for the United Kingdom, being the first to approve a vaccine. In an interview Tuesday morning, Health Secretary Matt Hancock broke down.
Just simple words there, reacting it. You're quite emotional by that.
Well, it's just, it's been such a tough year for so many people, and there's William Shakespeare putting it so simply for everybody that, you know, we can get on with our lives. And you know, there's still a few months to go. I've still got this worry that we can't blow it now, Piers. We've still got to get the vaccine to millions of people, and so we've got to keep sticking by the rules. But it's just, you know, there's so much work gone into this, and I'm really, really, it makes you proud to be British.
However, diminishing trust in the government has led to a lot of scepticism about the vaccine.
I think given the effects it's having, it's probably worth the risk. Not that I believe there is a risk, but I'd definitely be willing to take it.
Not right now. Do you know, it's too quickly. Like, the vaccine was made way too quickly for my own likings, and I don't think it's been tested well enough. And if it was possible to put a vaccine through this quickly, why haven't they done it before?
Because there's a pandemic going on around the world, and I don't think there's any conspiracy about it, and I've had vaccines when I was a little boy, and I'll take a vaccine now.
According to the largest survey of UK attitudes and behaviour during the pandemic, a fifth of people are likely to refuse a COVID vaccine. More than half believe that vaccines can cause unforeseen effects, and more than a third think natural immunity is better than immunity from vaccines.
Critical mass of people are going to have to get the vaccine in the coming weeks and months for it to work. The UK hasn't made it mandatory, so it might be a bit of an uphill job for the government to convince everyone that it is necessary and safe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the US have surpassed the grim milestone of 15 million cases during the deadliest week of the outbreak since April. The 7-day moving average of new cases has also surpassed 200,000 for the first time. The coronavirus outbreak has so far claimed over 286,000 lives in the world's worst hit country. A record number of more than 100,000 coronavirus patients were also in US hospitals on Monday. The latest figures come as the country struggles to approve the emergency use of a vaccine. U.S. President Donald Trump has come under harsh criticism for his mishandling of the pandemic and downplaying public health measures to halt the spread of the virus. The United States remains in a schizophrenic state more than a month after its disputed presidential vote. They informally observed the election's so-called Safe Harbor Day, but a huge majority of voters for Donald Trump insists the election is not over. Rami Mazari has more from Chicago.
November 8th was Safe Harbor Day in the United States, when all states were to have resolved any presidential election dispute. But it's clear the political seas remain incredibly stormy. It's difficult to know exactly what is going on because both sides have so many claims, counterclaims, supporters, and detractors. There are reportedly around 1,000 sworn testimonies alleging election irregularities, and yet no election-reversing smoking gun has yet been produced. Many government officials insist there was no vote fraud, but the nation's top intelligence official, the Director of National Intelligence, just said that all issues of election fraud must be investigated, and only then would we see, quote, whether there is a Biden administration.
Traditionally, when Republicans have brought up these complaints about voter fraud, they have been before an election to try to restrict the electorate to the ones they want. And the media, you know, has traditionally gone along with that. That's like fair ball, you know, excluding millions of people from voting is considered like fair. And what Trump's like doing now is by bringing it up afterwards, it's seen as like putting in doubt a peaceful transition in the U.S. And that's what the super rich really care about.
The constant message from corporate media is that the election is over, yet it's clear there is no such finality for scores of millions of American Republicans. Top pollster Gallup just reported that 83% of Republicans believe that challenger Joe Biden's projected win is not accurate, showing how widespread and firmly rooted are the doubts regarding the vote's integrity. In a historic move, Texas and Louisiana announced they are suing the swing states of Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, and Michigan, claiming that they manipulated the coronavirus pandemic as an excuse to unlawfully change their election rules. It appears to be the definitive challenge to the executive orders by some state governors to massively and controversially issue mail-in ballots, even though those orders were not checked and balanced with a state legislative vote. The Electoral College votes on December 14th, but Congress doesn't count the votes until January 6th, meaning election disputes seem likely to continue into next year, regardless of Safe Harbor Day. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
The federal New York judge has given the government 2 weeks to release documents it has withheld from the court and to provide legal justification for their non-disclosure. The human rights group Open Society Justice Initiative has hailed the ruling as a crucial victory in addressing the Donald Trump administration's, quote, shameful cover-up of Khashoggi's killing. The Washington Post columnist was killed and his body dismembered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul 2 years ago. The incident sparked international condemnations, with the CIA concluding that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the critic's murder. Investigative journalist Max Perry says there have been developments indicating the United States and Saudi Arabia might have colluded in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
CIA and the administration have seemingly been at odds as to who they believe ordered the killing. You know, Langley has pointed the finger at MBS, while on the other hand, Trump has been very, very deliberately vague as to what the CIA's findings were. And I think that that probably has to do with the fact that we know that it was, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who likely gave bin Salman the intelligence that the U.S. had on Mr. Khashoggi, including his travel logs leading up to the murder. And, it's no coincidence here that in the last few months of the outgoing administration, Kushner has been traveling in the region to the Gulf state kingdoms, including a stop in Riyadh to visit the Crown Prince. You know, it leads one to think, what's going on here? Is he covering his tracks? Did he have a hand personally as a mole? And did he give the Saudis the green light to do this? I think this ruling shows how there are other factors at play going on.
Elsewhere, Venezuela's parliamentary elections have given President Nicolas Maduro's socialist allies a sweeping victory. Maduro says the electoral win ratifies him as leader of the nation. Although the U.S. and the opposition have refused to recognize the election results, socialists have hailed the vote as completely transparent and valid. From Caracas, Newsweek Civil Report.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has described the triumph of his political alliance in the country's legislative elections as a popular ratification of his presidency. According to electoral officials, the ruling United Socialist Party and its allies secured over 67% of the vote. Maduro said that the country will be benefited by the new majority of socialists in the National Assembly, as now the legislature will work with him in the legal battle against the U.S. sanctions that have crippled the Venezuelan economy over the past few years. He said this election win will be followed by more victories.
Our Socialist Party has regained control of the parliament thanks to the people's votes. Now we'll also win in regional elections next year.
But the Venezuelan opposition has decried the election's outcome. But socialists dismissed the allegation of electoral fraud.
This election fulfills the rule of law and our voters deserve respect. The U.S. claims are totally unfounded.
Many opposition followers did not vote because they don't trust their own leaders, but it doesn't diminish the validity of the election.
Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party has won an overwhelming victory in the legislative elections. While the U.S. has denounced the election over fraud claims, millions of Venezuelans cast their votes in support of Maduro's party. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
The Sacred Defense literature is not a literary genre like other literary genres. It is like a bubbling spring where we can create all kinds of literature. We can use Sacred Defense literature to produce excellent historic, political, romantic, and familial texts and also to produce such materials for that literature itself. However, the important point is to produce text. We need to produce text. If good and eloquent texts are produced, then we can use them to write plays and to make movies. For example, I've heard that one of our committed poets has composed 10 ghazals, benefiting from the book written by our eloquent martyr, When the Moonlight Was Missing. Very well. If committed poets enter the arena, they can compose tens of collections by utilizing Sacred Defense materials. Poetry is a great art. The same is true of movies and the cinema. We should produce cinematic works and the like. This is being done in the world as well.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
In other countries in the world, too, perhaps the best cinematic works are based on excellent writings and texts. They use the outstanding and excellent novels that have been written before. We should do the same. We should produce these outstanding texts, and we should make movies and plays and then put them on the stage. So, it is an important task. I have heard that inside the country, they put on the stage the works of foreign writers such as Victor Hugo, and Charles Dickens. Very well. We should also do something to make others in other countries, first in our country and then in other countries, put our writings and texts on the stage and then produce movies out of them. In other words, we should focus our efforts on producing outstanding writings. Another point is about commemoration ceremonies. Commemoration ceremonies are an important discussion and a great task as they help bridge the gap between generations. They help young generations become familiar with the sacred defense. This will be effective in building personalities like Shahid Hojaji or other dear martyrs of defending the holy shrines. Of course, this is also another blessing and auspicious outcome of the sacred defense era.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
War, famine, and disease. These are just a few crises Yemen has been dealing with in over 5 years since the Saudi-led war broke out in the Arab country, aimed at bringing the government of former President Abdrabbo Mansour Hadi back to power and crushing the popular Ansarullah movement. In the meantime, the United States is reportedly considering designating Ansarullah, which has been resisting the Saudi-led aggression, as a terrorist group. Oman's Foreign Minister, Sayed Badr al-Busaidi, said the Assistant U.S. Secretary of State mentioned the possibility during a visit to Muscat. The development came a day after the United Nations and international aid agencies warned Washington against the plan, citing concerns that the move would prevent life-saving aid from reaching the war-wracked country and would derail a related $700 million relief program.
Well, the major problem, of course, aside from the fact that the designation is completely, you know, uncalled for, it's unfair and unjust, for the basic reason that Ansarullah is not engaged in any terrorist attacks whatsoever and cannot in any way, shape, or form be considered a terrorist organization. They have never instigated an unprovoked attack against civilian targets in any country, neither in Yemen itself nor in nations abroad. And even the attacks on Saudi territory that they are being blamed for are legitimate military retaliations against a conflict that has been enforced upon them by Saudi Arabia.
David Beasley, executive director of the UN's World Food Program, told the Washington Post Daily newspaper earlier this week that the designation could hamper aid deliveries. Beasley's warning came following his meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in which he expressed grave concerns about the blacklisting of Ansarullah. Last week, dozens of arms control and human rights organizations denounced a U.S. plan to sell multi-billion dollars worth of arms to the United Arab Emirates. In a letter to the U.S. Senate Department and Congress, 29 advocacy groups warned that arming the UAE would cause more humanitarian crises as the country is a party to the conflicts in Yemen and Libya. The groups added that U.S. President Donald Trump's possible designation of Yemen's Ansarullah as a terrorist group can have catastrophic impacts on the world's largest humanitarian crisis and response, while also hampering UN-led efforts to secure a ceasefire and start peace talks. UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffith, who has been mediating between the warring sides, called last month for all parties to the conflict to take final decisions required to implement a pact that aims to bring a nationwide ceasefire, specific measures to improve the lives of Yemenis, and the resumption of the political process to reach a lasting peace.
This is not necessarily an issue of who you support and who you oppose. This is not necessarily an issue of supporting Ansar Allah, supporting the revolution of September 21 of 2014. They're not necessarily support to the National Salvation Government or to the organization that is called the Houthis, Ansar Allah. You don't have to support them in order to agree that the United Nations peace negotiations are probably the only way to stop this conflict without either party having to be completely defeated in the field. If you want to stop the conflict and prevent further bloodshed and prevent the drawing out of this war for years to come, then you need to negotiate.
The ongoing conflict in Yemen shows no sign of abating, with more civilians being killed and displaced every day. In the meantime, the United States' moves on Yemen have not only damaged the horizons for peace, but also hampered efforts to provide much-needed aid to millions of people.
On Friday, the news agency Reuters published a report on a confidential letter sent by Iran to the International Atomic Energy Agency on Iran. The letter contained information on Iran's safeguard measures in its nuclear enrichment plant in the central city of Natanz. The leak prompted an angry reaction from Iran and other countries. Iran condemned the IAEA and criticized the leak. Iran's permanent envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said that the agency is responsible for the incident and that the agency's confidentiality mechanisms are seriously flawed. He said that Iran will shortly take legal action over the leak of information. Gharibabadi stressed that reporting confidential information without following the declassification procedure is illegal.
All safeguards and JCPOA reports, as well as Iran's correspondence with the IAEA and vice versa, are confidential. The IAEA shares its reports in its internal site, only accessible to its member states.
Gharibabadi said that Tehran has already asked the agency to minimize the amount of details it gives its member states in its reports and to avoid providing them with non-essential information. He said the history of Iran's legal protests against the IAEA over its failure to preserve confidential information dates back more than two decades.
In 2018, the Washington Post reported that Israeli intelligence agencies and experts have been have gotten a hold, actually, of sensitive information of Iran's nuclear capability through the IAEA. And this is no accident, given that the IAEA is heavily biased towards Israel. So it's natural that the spies involved have had institutional leverage as well with officials that were working with the IAEA and using it as an opportunity to extract information about Iran's nuclear capabilities.
Indeed, the incident is the latest in a series of tensions between Iran and the IAEA over the matter. This is not the first time that confidential information on Iran is leaked by the Atomic Agency. Over the years, and even before signing the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, confidential information related to Iran has been leaked to non-parties to the JCPOA on many occasions. After signing the deal, Iran witnessed leakage of its confidential reports and information by the UN nuclear watchdog numerous times. With ongoing tension between Iran and the UN nuclear agency, it may be safe to say that the trust between Iran and the IAEA is at its lowest level. Observers say that the IAEA-Iran cooperation problems and lack of trust between them comes from a series of issues. The main reason can be that the UN nuclear watchdog's unprofessional behavior in conducting inspections in Iran. Tehran says on numerous occasions the agency's request was based on unfounded documents or baseless allegations. There were also incidents that fueled the distrust. One of the most significant cases was an IAEA inspector who tried to contaminate the Iranian nuclear facilities with nuclear materials of an unknown origin. Another case was the explosion that occurred at the Natanz nuclear facility. Iran says the only official party that has the details of the activities at Natanz was the IAEA. Observers say incidents like these are the source of distrust between Iran and the agency. No wonder Iran hesitates to allow certain inspections on its nuclear facilities. There are also serious allegations that indicate IAEA's mismanagement to protect Tehran's confidential information, which has led to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the years. U.S. political influence on the IAEA is another reason. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018 and imposed the toughest ever sanctions under its so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Experts say now the U.S. is trying to turn the nuclear agency into part of their pressure campaign. They say the U.S. has always exploited international institutions to implement their policies against certain countries when they fail to directly pressure those countries.
There's no doubt about it. The IAEA is serving as a direct intelligence arm between Israel, the European Union, and the United States as an agency that has consistently demonstrated its bias and preferential treatment in favor of Israel, who have consistently used the agency to lobby for harsher aggression and action against Iran, in favor, obviously, of Israel, who at the same time is not a signatory on the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, and has weapons stockpiles, nuclear stockpiles of its own that it does not allow any inspection of by international agencies.
Iran has always expressed readiness to further cooperate with the IAEA in a bid to reach an understanding on the unresolved issues. It also announced that it had full cooperation with the UN nuclear agency. However, the recent incident shows that the IAEA once again has failed to build trust with Iran, which raises the question as to why Tehran should continue trusting the agency with its confidential information.
It seems that there's finally a light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to the development and administration of a vaccine against the COVID-19 virus, with multiple research centres finally in the latter stages of producing a viable and effective vaccine against the virus. However, while so close to the end, is the decision by the British to roll out the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine a little too soon. Already the British and the US have been arguing about the timing of the promise by the British government to start inoculating the most vulnerable groups of people in the UK by as early as this coming Monday, with the US criticising the British either due to the early release of a yet untested product, or maybe through jealousy of being pipped to the post by the Brits. With the UK having the worst rates in Europe, with already 60,000 people dead from the virus, the US is also in a difficult situation, with around 1,500 people dying each day, and already 276,000 people having succumbed to the coronavirus in America. Embarrassing figures for the outgoing president of the United States, who would have no doubt enjoyed being the first to distribute the vaccine. So why then are the British and Americans fighting over the issue? With the British choosing to start with the order of 40 million Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines, it seems odd that they have chosen a vaccine developed outside of the UK. Yet when one examines the effectiveness of the vaccines available, the British version, developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, is only around 62% effective. Hence maybe why the British have rushed ahead with the German-US version, quicker than the Americans and the Germans themselves. So could the tension then come from the attitude of the British when it comes to wanting to get the vaccine out as quickly as possible, rushing it through the regulators at such a pace? British Education Minister Gavin Williamson clearly flared tempers with his attitude towards the US and the EU when he stated that British regulators were obviously better, and then going one step further, saying the whole of the UK was better than the US and the EU. Clearly a diplomatic flop by publicly stating such words.
What now remains to be seen is A, just how realistic the monumental task of distributing a vaccine that needs to be kept at minus 70 degrees will be, and B, will the US show any sympathy towards the UK should the process fail, and as Britain comes crashing out of the EU, looking at the US for a future trade deal. Britain is against the ropes when it comes to the Brexit negotiations with the EU. However, the announcement that the British will have the vaccine out on Monday is something that the British negotiating team will secretly be proud of as talks reach a stalemate in London. But the EU, with all its red tape, bureaucracy and processes, has yet to fully approve any developed vaccine so far and has taken the opportunity to criticise the UK for a hasty decision when it comes to announcing the vaccine will be available to various groups within Britain. Until the European Medicines Agency approves the vaccine, the rest of the continent will have to remain patient. However, there are arguments that the EMA is more rigorous than the British, leading the Germans to label the move by the British as problematic. But the UK may have one valid point when it comes to the rollout. If the vaccine is truly over 95% effective and it can save lives, then what's wrong with the British taking such a step? With the British finding themselves stuck in a desperate situation when it comes to agreeing a deal with the EU in the post-Brexit era, and time fast running out before the deadline approaches to switch to WTO rules, could then the decision by the British to start distribution be a final dig at the EU and prove that by no longer being part of the bloc, it can take such decisions without fallout that would have emerged from Brussels should they still have been members? But the truth of the matter is simple. This is one of the world's worst cases of a global pandemic, at least in modern times, and the economic impact, as well as the devastating cost of life, has left a scar and legacy that will never be forgotten. So whether it be Pfizer-BioNTech, AstraZeneca, Moderna, or Gamaleya, and whether it's the UK, the US, or the EU, or in fact any other country that starts the vaccine first, at the end of the day, this is a humanitarian issue, and when the time comes, the whole world will need the doses eventually.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have managed to flee Myanmar's northwestern state of Rakhine, where they repeatedly came under attack by the army and extremist Buddhists. Many of these refugees have come to Bangladesh over the past years. They have largely been camped in the southern district of Cox's Bazar in overcrowded camps and in squalid conditions. This week, Bangladeshi authorities began moving Rohingya families from the camps near the Myanmar border without their consent. Bangladeshi police escort the refugees in buses to a port and then to this island. Basan Char is their destination, a flood-prone island vulnerable to frequent cyclones. The remote island, the Bay of Bengal, emerged from the sea 20 years ago. The government of Bangladesh says it has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on a small city there with mosques and red-roofed apartment blocks. It says the relocation will ease chronic overcrowding in camps at Cox's Bazar. But the refugees are unwilling to set foot on the remote island. There are many concerns about the conditions of the brand new settlement. For instance, distance from the mainland will make it very difficult to reach the refugees in emergencies. Meanwhile, hundreds of Rohingya who were sent to the island in April after being picked up at sea don't want to remain there. They have accused settlement guards of sexual assault. Bangladeshi authorities have not allowed the United Nations or rights groups to monitor their relocation.
It really raises the question, what is Bangladesh hiding if, you know, it has gone to such controversial length to decline offer, consistently offered by the United Nations agencies and UN itself to do basic safety assessment of the island.
Rights groups want Bangladesh to halt the controversial move immediately. Rohingya Muslims are recognized by the UN as the world's worst persecuted minority group. In January, the United Nations highest court ordered Buddhist majority Myanmar to prevent genocidal violence against its Rohingya Muslim minority and preserve evidence of past attacks. The International Court of Justice instructed the Asian country to respect the requirements of the 1948 Genocide Convention. The ICJ warned that nearly 600,000 Rohingya Muslims who are still in Myanmar are, quote, extremely vulnerable to violence at the hands of the military. But since the ICJ ruling, little has really changed. Human rights lawyers and activists said recently that Myanmar is continuing to commit genocide against Rohingya Muslims in violation of orders by the UN's top court. The ongoing crisis has left the international reputation of Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who is a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, in tatters. Suu Kyi has defended the actions of the army and is unwilling to change her stance. Many rights groups and Rohingya activists have been demanding that she be stripped of her Nobel Peace Prize, but so far no meaningful action has been taken against her or the military.
Myanmar government has not really been put under any type of concerted pressure, you know, not by the United States, not by the European Union, not by British government, not certainly not by China or India or Japan.
Powerful states have considerable trade ties with Myanmar. They can easily use their economic leverage to force change in Myanmar's behavior, but they have chosen not to exert pressure on the country over the plight of the minority group.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-Aliyy al-Azim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyyina Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin la siyama baqiyatillah fil arabin ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif wa ja'alana min a'wanihi wa ansarih. Last night we spoke about the way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has provided humanity with guidance for their personal progress and also for establishing a community, a universal community based on justice as a major value and other values that inshallah we will talk about it. When it comes to personal progress, all the prophets helped humanity in order to combat their ego, in order to combat temptations coming from their nafs ammare, their commanding soul, from Satan. They try to take them from darkness to light. But when it comes to establishing a just society, it was the job of the messengers, of the Rusul, who were given the book and Mizan, the scale or the balance, so that they would lead and guide humanity towards establishment of this social justice. لقد أرسلنا رسلنا بالبينات وأنزلنا معهم الكتاب والميزان ليقوم الناس بالقسط. Allah has sent His messenger with guidance and the religion of truth. The path, religion, deen means path. This is the path of truth. Anyone in the world who is interested in truthfulness, who is interested in honesty, will find this religion acceptable. Inshallah, I will explain that there can be people who are not Muslims, but they are truthful and honest. In my understanding, these are closer to Islam than those Muslims who are not honest. There can be people who don't say prayer, but they never tell lies. And there are people who say prayer and they always tell lies. The first group is closer to Islam. Our hadith says, Mu'min may do many sins, but he never tells lies. Never is dishonest. Never deceives people. Never cheats. Among all the qualities of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, why he was known as Amin? Have you ever reflected on this? Before Islam, Rasulullah was still known as Amin. He was honest, he was truthful. For sure, he had many other good qualities. He was brave, he was kind, he was clever, he was intelligent. Why this quality was very much outstanding? I was reflecting on this. My conclusion is this: because for his future role as a prophet, as a guide, people had to trust his honesty. If Rasulullah had all other qualities, but he was not known to be Amin, how could people accept what he says? How could they be wholeheartedly following him, changing their lifestyle, giving up their idols that were very dear to them, and even sacrificing their lives and money for this message? If Rasulullah was not Amin, who was going to follow him?
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
So, this is a great lesson for us. If you want to have good children as parents, you have to be known by your children as Amin. If you want to have good students, as a teacher, you have to be known as honest and truthful. If you are an alim that you want the community to believe in what you say, you have to be known by the community as Amin. And if we as a Muslim community want to have respect of non-Muslims for us, we have to be known as Amin. People should tell each other
that there might be problems with Muslims. Maybe some of them are not, I don't know, well educated. Maybe some of them, I don't know, are not that clever or intelligent or whatever. But they are all honest. They are all truthful. You can never see a Muslim lying or cheating. This is what we have to establish. If we had this quality, then even little tabligh was enough to make people love Islam. And when you don't have this quality, if you have all the satellite channels and all the websites and publish thousands of books, you know, every day, people would not trust. Because you are not known as honest and truthful. So this is Deen al-Haq. This is the religion of truth and truthfulness. هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق. Allah is the one who has sent this messenger. No one else is able to send such a message with such a messenger. It is Allah. Do you know why? Because Allah is al-haq. ذلك بأن الله هو الحق. So it is Al-Haq who can send the religion of Haq. Quran says, بِالْحَقِّ أَنْزَلْنَاهُ وَبِالْحَقِّ نَزَلْ. Al-Haq sent this message truthfully, and the message was delivered truthfully and shared with people truthfully. إنه لكتاب عزيز لا يأتيه الباطل لا من بين يدي ولا من خلف. There is no chance for battle, for falsehood to penetrate. Of course, this is before reaching me and you. When it comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to the Prophet, and Prophet delivers, everything is al-haq. When it comes to people like me and you, then it is a test. Whether we do our best to understand that message truthfully and share it with people truthfully, or we bring things from our pocket and mind and add to this religion to suit our interests, that is the big problem.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe as hard, and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and all Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. Oh Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman.